matters of slavery and minority, religious and ethnic minority identity. And the account that follows grows out of a recent article about to be published in the journal Slavery and Abolition on remembering slavery and abolition in Bristol, which is where I live. And it builds on my 12 years of experience working as an academic advisor to slavery museum exhibitions and websites and leading a lottery-funded project on a public history project concerning minority identities. I'd like to begin with an anecdote. Early in 2007, whilst on a bus traveling through Bristol's city centre, I passed a statue of the city's most famous benefactor, the late 17th century merchant Edward Colston, who was a great benefactor of the city. I noticed something rather disquieting about the statue. Colston's feet were streaked with scarlet, and there were rivulets of what looked like blood dripping down over his nameplate. It was red paint, of course, not splashed across the statue as it had been 9 years earlier when the obscenity F off slave trader had been spray painted across the statue. This was altogether more subtle and more chilling. The guerrilla artist Banksy was said by some to have been responsible. Now, the image of Colston's bleeding statue is particularly pertinent to this conference's subtitle, Remedying the Past. It illuminates how the past can leave wounds not simply on a dead statue, but on the body politic itself. For the vandalization of the statue unleashed a storm of contention which shattered any consensus about Bristol's collective image of its own past. It shows, too, that the very universal questions about slavery, human rights, and reparations are played out in local contexts, contexts whose specific histories policymakers ignore at their peril. There is, I would argue, an urgent need for impartial academic and historical analysis, which other speakers have signaled. And I would also stress that this historical scholarship needs to be integrated into the public representation of the history of slavery, even where difficult and controversial questions are raised, especially around two things which I'm going to be talking about, white resentment and African complicity. Now, for many years, the official response to Bristol's slaving history was characterized by what can always only be called denial in official circles. But since the late 1990s, when Colston's when we had a major slavery exhibition I was involved with, and when Colston's involvement in the transatlantic slave trade became more widely known, he was a director, after all, of the Royal African Company, his statue has become a symbolic lightning rod for highly charged attitudes about race history and public memory. If the public remembrance of slavery in Bristol then is uniquely informed by its cult of Colston, and it is a cult, Colston alone has not shaped Bristol's attitudes to its slaving past because, as most of you will know, Bristol was, after all, Britain's second most important slaving port until Liverpool displaced it in the 1750s. Between 1698 and 1807, over 2,100 Bristol ships brought nearly 500,000 enslaved Africans to the Western Hemisphere. And throughout the 18th century, sugar refining, tobacco processing, chocolate, etc., dominated the city's industrial life. And at least two-thirds of the city's export trade was tied up in one way or another with the slave-based economy. The city's involvement with the Atlantic slave system also continued for well over half a century after the abolition of the slave trade. Its continuing reliance on slave-produced tobacco and cotton from America until 1863, and its enduring commercial, cultural, and familial links with the Caribbean and America, and its trading links with West Africa, ensured that public engagement with issues around both slavery and race would continue to have a particular resonance in the city, even before post-war immigration from Jamaica and Barbados, and later West Africa, altered forever the city's demographic profile. The past decade in particular has seen a series of stormy debates in the local press, not only about the appropriateness of having Colston's statue still preside over the city center, but about the future of Colston Hall, the city's main concert venue, and the proposed renaming of Bristol Central Shopping Precinct as Merchants' Quarters, and the continued existence of Colston's birthday as a civic event. Such debates rage with particular gusto around in the bicentennial year of the abolition of the British slave trade. Colston aside, the debates have largely been framed in terms of whether contemporary citizens should bear any guilt or responsibility for a trade which officially ended two centuries before. And implicit in these arguments smolders the question of reparations. Indeed, reparations has been such a contentious issue that the term itself is usually avoided. In 2006, as you know, we had Tony Blair's expression of regret, which in Bristol was followed in January 2007 with a similar expression of regret by the Lord Mayor, the Council, and the Black Council of Churches. Apology was avoided as it implied some sort of admission of legal responsibility, which it was feared might open the door to reparations. The dominant public discourse in the city, however, kept returning to the question of whether the city owed somebody, assumed to be Black, an apology. This was true of the local press and true of the director of the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, who in May 2006 staged a public debate over whether Bristol should apologize for its involvement in the slave trade. It was chaired by the philosopher A.C. Grayling, involved seven leading cultural commentators, and attracted a 500-strong audience comprised largely of more educated whites and politically engaged African Caribbeans who were asked to vote on this issue. Nearly two-thirds of the audience, they voted in favor of an apology. And this was a sort of rebuke to the more mealy-mouthed expression of regret which the official body in Bristol had endorsed. But the support for an apology was in direct contrast to a contemporaneous poll staged by BBC Bristol Telethon and website, where only 9% of respondents in Bristol were in favor of an apology. Such a result echoed the sentiments expressed in the letters page of the local press and in a BBC Bristol phone-in on the subject in 2005, and in the many conversations I have had with white Bristolians since 1997 as part of my work on the history of slavery in the region. The disparity within the constituency of whites about the question of slavery reveals not a simple division on racial grounds, but a more complex range of responses, which I've examined in my Slavery and Abolition article. Those hostile to the idea of the notion of an apology, of course, would be by implication against any idea of reparation, which was largely assumed to mean forms of financial payment to the descendants of enslaved Africans. No voters were resentful about the prospect of either an apology or reparations on a variety of grounds. Firstly, that contemporary people, particularly those who came from working class backgrounds, could hardly be held to be responsible for slavery when their ancestors themselves had been exploited as wage slaves. And that wage slave epithet echoes 18th century discourses going right back to William Cobbett and, of course, Orchard Hunt, who was resident in Bristol. You had a radical tradition which was championing white working class values and hostile to the supposedly lenient treatment accorded to enslaved Africans. And it was also said that we could not judge people in the past by present-day standards, and that slavery ended a long time ago. The past was the past. It was foolish to excuse contemporary difficulties of Black Britons in the diaspora or in Africa to events in that distant past. The past was seen as hermetically sealed from the present. Another argument was that as Africans sold their own, it was a very undifferentiated view of Africa, into slavery, why should whites apologize? There was also, perhaps more peculiar to Bristol, the widespread misapprehension that the number of white indentured servants, convicted criminals, political prisoners, and children spirited away from the Bristol region in the 17th and 18th century, perhaps numbering to the tens of thousands, to work as virtual slaves in the Caribbean and American plantations, was more or less comparable to the number of enslaved Africans transported to the Americas. People just didn't have any conception, if we were to go by the 2,000 respondents to the first slavery exhibition, of the millions of people involved in the transatlantic Middle Passage. Less explicit, but very much in the ether when you dug below the surface, was the widely held opinion that African Caribbean people in the inner city, Bristol, notably in St. Paul's, where there had been a riot or urban disturbance in 1980, were associated with high levels of criminality and were using slavery as an excuse for their own underachievement in society. There was resentment, too, which was muted but palpable, that the labor government at both local and national level was prepared, wrongly, it was implied, to spend money on slavery-related projects. In fact, it was $2 million from the lottery fund that had been allocated for such things. And it was seen as wrong given the financial constraints affecting white people in the view of, guise of housing, waiting lists, and so constrictions on social service provision. This was connected to a resentment of the politically correct elite and their petty bureaucratic underlings who undermines local civic and national pride with this constant focus on, or harping on, as the term kept going on, about slavery. And you got on one website the term slavery fatigue. The longer term legacies of the transatlantic slave trade were really taken on board according to people's educational level, but I think even with people who are more highly educated, the notion that black people suffered psychologically from the enslavement of their ancestors, the psychological and identity notions of the legacy of slavery were simply not grasped. There just wasn't the empathy. And another argument, which was used by those who wished to present themselves as more progressive politically, was that a focus on past slavery wrongly diverted attention, and necessarily diverted attention, away from the more urgent questions about slavery today. These voices, these exemplars of white resentment, tended to be dismissed or marginalized by those in local and national government trying to implement policy about Abolition 200. Yet to ignore this resentment, though it is based on ignorance and misapprehension, ignores the fact that there was this perceived sense of injustice, particularly against middle-class elites who were focusing, it was seen, more on race rather than class. It was an easier thing to do. And there was also a criticism which also deserves some sort of debate about what do we mean by apology rather than acknowledgement. Now, if we turn to another constellation of attitudes to the commemoration of slavery and reparations, i.e. that of African and African-Caribbean people in Bristol, I avoid the word community because it's much more disparate than that, we can use as an exemplar or a November 2008 meeting organized by an umbrella organization, African Voices, which dealt directly with the question of reparations. A small audience of perhaps 20 people, mainly West African, but some African-Caribbean people, was attended in St. Paul's in Bristol. And at that meeting, I think some unresolved aspects of the reparation questions, interestingly, surfaced. Abu Sharif, one of the moving forces behind this group, had attended the expert group meeting on slavery in Banjul, Gambia, in June 2008, which itself followed on from the UN-sponsored World Conference Against Racism in Durban in 2001. And both in Banjul and in Bristol, there was complete support for the idea of reparation, though interestingly, reparations was seen as simply not just about money. It was seen as demeaning to put a monetary value on human suffering, and it was impractical to make financial reparations. So it's a much more nuanced response than white people had sort of envisaged it would be. But on the other hand, there was confusion because between the idea of fair trade and reparations, and the two terms were conflated in the Bristol discussion. There was also a real passion for an acknowledgement of the destructive impact of slavery to be recognized in the school curriculum, the mass media, and public commemoration. And that dovetails with a whole series of meetings within the African-Caribbean population throughout the last few years about the need not to reduce black history to the experience of slavery because this was so deleterious on the self-esteem and image of young black people. Some interesting ambiguities and confusions in the discussion that followed included not just the conflation of free trade and social justice for Africa with the reparations question, but the whole question of civic memorial, and here it takes a particular sort of Bristol slant. The Colston statue still aroused tremendous debate. Should it be junked? Should it be relabeled? Or do we just need to keep it? There was another question. Bristol has two roads, White Ladies Road and Black Boy Hill. And people spoke passionately about how demeaning it was to walk up White Ladies Road, which it was assumed was where white ladies in the 18th century paraded slave boys up to Black Boy Hill. The actual historical record suggests that White Ladies Road was named after the habits worn by medieval nuns in a Carmelite priory in that area. And Black Boy Hill, well, the historical record is more mixed. It might refer to Charles II, but it probably, given the number of Black Boy and Trumpet pubs in the area, probably does have a slavery connection. but it's sort of the redskin syndrome alluded to. What do you do when there's a beloved couple of streets or a beloved statue, beloved by the majority community? Do you just get rid of it? Is it seen as a Stalinesque airbrushing of history? Or to what extent do you have to educate the whole public to reevaluate its historic landmark? So there's all sorts of questions being raised here. And there's also what I would call the Saracen's Head syndrome. There are pubs called the Saracen's Head. No one thought about it until 9/11. And all of a sudden, the whole sort of issue of crusades and how these long latent legacies suddenly resurface given the changed political context. Most interesting for me was the discussion on African complicity. It was said that it was said in the meeting in Bristol, if we admit African complicity, it would scupper demand for reparations from the West. So it's best avoided in some quarters. Other people felt that it was essential to look at African complicity in the slave trade. We had to confront it, if only to be able to confront problems of bad governance and political leadership in Africa today. But generally it was seen and characterized that African complicity, though it may have existed, was something forced upon Africans. The argument that the transatlantic slave trade empowered warlords favoring slavery through supplying them with armaments and enabling them to conquer people who were not involved in the slave trade was not an argument that was utilized in this debate. And I think that more nuanced argument, which issues from historical research, would be integrated with profit into the public domain. There was also, although there was acknowledgement that African domestic slavery existed, it tended to be idealized and romanticized in a way that completely marginalized the gendered aspects of enslavement. On the one hand, the fact that even domestic slavery, where people might over the generations be integrated into the family, often meant sexual subjugation, particularly of women within that domestic sphere, was not taken on board. And also the different form, it was assumed that all African slavery was small-scale domestic slavery and the centralized authoritarian regimes in Dahomey or Accra in the gold mines where you had much harsher regimes of enslavement were not taken on board. There was also a subtext regarding Jewish and black relations which surfaced. There was a kind of ambivalence, an admiration about the Jewish success in obtaining reparations, but it was also tinged with envy and resentment about this and a misapprehension that all Jews benefited from reparations. There was a subtext of anti-Semitic rhetoric. One speaker referred to slave traders as Ashkenazi, which is a collective term for Eastern European Jewry, and was not challenged. So I think more outreach work from Jewish reparations group to black grassroots groups would be one step in favor of informing the debate. I would like to echo Diane Shelton's argument about the need for more nuanced historical research, and for that research to be popularized, and also for that research to have a sensitivity to local concerns and passions and discourses. Not only to debunk the misinformation and ignorance within majority and minority popular perceptions, but also to enable people to take on board deeply felt perceptions about slavery more honestly and constructively, to engage with a census of real or misconceived about unfairness and injustice in both the majority and minority constituencies. But research in itself is not enough. There needs to be a willingness on the part of museum practitioners and educationalists to confront difficult historical issues courageously and in nuanced ways. I think there's a new in the Labour government policies of inclusion and the wish to move away from more elitist representations of the past. There is also contempt for historical research in favour of attracting non-traditional audiences and for having particular lines which celebrate rather than critically analyse the past. And I think all humans are equal, but all stories about past injustices are not, that we still need to look at the evidence in a fair-minded and courageous way. Thank you very much.